Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So we are officially a week into Roland Garros 2020, 8 days to go, because of course there are 15 greedy days in the French Open. I think it's safe to say that my central heating after 2 days has now become a permanent fixture of my autumn winter. I think the same can probably be said of the Philippe Chatrier roof for the coming days, because things are looking pretty grim over in Paris. I'm joined by Matt and David as per usual, but I'm also delighted to say joining us from quarantine is Simon Briggs. Simon, how are you doing?
I think you thought I was going to be in Paris when you invited me, didn't you?
Well, I know you have been in Paris. You have certainly experienced Paris, and we're very eager to hear all about it. But you've now returned and are having to quarantine accordingly. Was the trip worth the quarantine?
Not sure it was. I mean, I got a call actually from the government within about 18 hours of getting back. They called me on the first lunchtime, the first day that technically I was quarantining. So that doesn't include the day of your return, which was actually quite impressive, I thought. That they were saying, do you realise that you have to stay in your house for 14 days? And this is the first day of your confinement. But yeah, I'm not sure that it was the best deal I've ever struck.
Did they ask you how your experience of the tennis was?
No, they didn't actually ask me why I'd been out of the country. I'm not sure they'd believe me if I told them.
We've all been discussing our impressions of this very bizarre French Open, obviously from a distance, watching it all as we are on screens, and trying to put our fingers and identify what exactly is making it feel so different, so weird. It's not that there aren't good things about it and highlights, and we're all very glad it's happening, but it is a strange experience. And you know, David's been working with Russell Fuller, who's out there for the BBC, who I know you'll have seen from a distance, Simon. And he said midweek, was it, David? He said this does not feel like a Grand Slam tournament. Would you say the same, Simon? Was that your feeling too?
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely unlike anything else. I mean, it's obviously outdoor tennis played as an indoor time of year. And it's Russell actually summed it up best when he described the venue as feeling like a seaside resort out of season, which was because he's not only doing all the broadcasting, but he's actually writing better than us too. The experience was really quite surreal, being there, just as it was watching it, I think. And ultimately, it's just been, if it had been a beautiful autumn, you know, there would have been a sense perhaps of getting that feel of that clay in the sunshine. You know, it's such a distinctive colour, isn't it? And I think I would have been there. I've been to Paris many times for the Paris Masters when it's been lovely, but obviously, it's been a bit of an apocalyptic autumn, both here and there. So that's been coming through on the TV and in person.
Is that it? Is the weather the biggest contributing factor to the weirdness?
Yeah, the weather and the temperature, and obviously the people aren't there. I mean, that's been the same for everything. So I suppose almost we're becoming accustomed to that. So, but also, Roland Garros is a peculiar space. I mean, it doesn't half look ropey when you're walking along the main corridor back from Longland towards the new airport terminal style of Châtrier. Weirdly, there's this massive concrete runway running all the way up to the top gate. And there's this great big grill, which is emitting steam like a New York metro underground tunnel. So you're getting that effect at the same time as you're walking back to the press box, which is now also underground in another change of scene. But I suppose it wouldn't be much difference the amount of natural light coming in.
How many press are there on site, and what's the environment like in the media areas? Is there any kind of camaraderie? Are you able to socialise at all, or is it all sort of too socially distanced and bizarre for that?
Yeah, we definitely had some good chats down there. Your colleague from Amazon, Marcus Buckland, popped by a few times. One afternoon, we found ourselves watching videos of Ortiz Dealey presenting the World Athletics Championships for no particular reason. And the French were right behind us, and they obviously they were kind of more engaged in the tournament. A lot of French players making some headway, some great French wins to look at. So it didn't feel too bad in the press centre. Just perhaps a little gloomy in terms of the natural light and the feeling of being underground beneath the bowels of Châtrier.
We've had another great French win today, haven't we? Speaking of great French wins,
with Fiona Ferro. Yeah, well, she.
I thought David and Matt were going to jump in there. They were early. Well, certainly Matt was an early Fiona Ferro adopter. David has rather jumped on his bandwagon, and now it's everybody's bandwagon.
Yeah, quite right. I was worried that when David predicted Fiona Ferro to win the other day, he was going to just sort of get those points and then Fiona Ferro would go out and I wouldn't get any credit for predicting Ferro to get to the quarterfinals before the tournament. Kind of like a Sasnovic situation we had at the US Open, I remember. Some bandwagon jumping and taking of my predictions points. But yes, Fiona Ferro has backed up her win over Heather Watson and Elena Rybakina, and she is now into the fourth round by beating Patricia Maria Thig, who is another in-form clay court player. And this was probably my match of the day. I watched this one, and the first set was 83 minutes. Ferro just sneaked through it, but then Thig came back, and then Ferro won the third set 6-love. So it was an impressive regroup after dropping the second set. And it was one of those matches as well that had a crowd, you know, like we were talking about yesterday with those other French players involved, Gaston and Garcia. It just seems to make quite a bit of a difference when there's a significant crowd in there, and particularly today, because Thig was quite happy to play the role of villain. And she started getting booed, and she really seemed to lap that up and sort of started hissing back at them and fist pumping even more and cheering even more loudly for herself. She was really embracing that role, and it kind of injected some real life into the match. And it was really high quality tennis as well.
It's not a French Open until the Parisian crowd have started booing someone for no particularly worthwhile reason, is it? Presumably, Simon, you have seen Fiona Ferro with your very own eyes because she beat Heather Watson in the opening round. Did you see that match? How impressive is she?
Yeah, I mean, she's 23, isn't she? So it's almost like a sort of a French Jennifer Brady scenario.
We don't talk about her here, Simon.
Won the first tournament back in Palermo. I mean, what an athlete. Just really neat player, but it's a physicality that impresses you. And actually, I was looking her up, I didn't realise that she's really Belgian, but moved Belgian in her ancestry, and then moved when she was very young. But I mean, she you could see her as Belgian, couldn't you? She does have something of the sort of that style of tennis about her.
What is a Belgian style of tennis?
A sort of very neat, technically correct, quite physical, perhaps less kind of flashy than the French.
Is she still your femme du jour, David? Did you see that match? Were you with her all the way?
I didn't see it. I was following the results. I mean, I when you talk about the Belgian type of player, I mean, I know it's a heck of a stereotype, but she looks like And a lot of those players do look like they've just rolled out of a PE lesson where they were the star of the class. You know, they've just no frills, but they just happen to be the best physically. And she could pull off any sport you like. And she does. I really liked watching her the other day, and I'm pleased she came through today. I was listening to some of it. And the only other thing I wanted to ask Matt about it, having seen it, was whether the crowd was stressed watching her. Because when they watched Garcia, I sense this anxiety on the part of the crowd as well as the player. What is it like with Ferro today?
I didn't sense stress. I think it helped that she won the first set, so she was kind of in control of the match from the start in that way that Garcia wasn't. And also what we talked about yesterday with Garcia is a known quantity, and there's a history of her struggling to close out matches and getting nervous. And I think I imagine that the 1,000 fans on site are probably fairly knowledgeable tennis fans. They've probably really, you know, they've probably gone out of their way to try and go to that event. So I think they were very aware of the Garcia backstory, and everyone was sensing the wobble before it even came yesterday. Whereas with Ferro, I think they're kind of discovering probably who she is and what she's like as a tennis player. And it was just a match to kind of just appreciate, I think. They weren't too stressed by it. They were involved and obviously cheering for their home player, but I didn't sense stress in the same way that we had with Garcia.
I wonder if she keeps winning, whether she will emerge with an emergency kit sponsor, like some players that have surprise success out of nowhere sometimes have. Do you remember Dan Evans' run at the Australian Open a few years ago, and he was going down to what was it, Woolworths or something, or Kmart, and buying his kit? That was a good line, wasn't it? Or was it the US Open?
That was from the greatest ever press conference that was ever held in tennis, when there were six different lines that could have made the top. He also had a row with Kevin Peterson, didn't he? And a row with Tomic. Was it? And Tomic's dad. And then he gave a very moving speech of condolence to his late Belgian coach, Julian Hofeland. So there was like, Dan Evans had really not said anything interesting for a year. And then he did it all in 15 minutes.
You could have done with him drip feeding that over 6 days, couldn't you, really?
It was a bit of a waste, you know. It was like a banquet when you just ordered a pizza.
Fiona Ferro now is one Sofia Kenin away from fulfilling your pre-tournament prediction, Matt. David asked about the anxiety of the French fans watching her today. How are you going to be watching her in a couple of days' time? That is a lot on the line, because I'm loath to say it. I'd be even more loath to say it if it was David. But that would be so massive if you got Ferro in the quarters pre-tournament.
Yeah, we have our algorithm, which kind of rewards risk and bold picks. So that would be 50 points if Ferro does make it through past Kenin. So I was kind of anticipating that Kenin might have gone out by now, I think, when I made that prediction. I'm suddenly feeling a little less confident about it, because Kenin was quite good today. I believe she won very easily and said that she felt much better on the court, much more confident, and it was her best performance of the week. But I think that will be a very, very close match.
Yeah, she 6-2-6 love over Arina Barra today, and it was 12 games in a row. So from 2-2 all in the opening set, it was love and love for Kenin, which, regardless of the quality of opposition, has to make you feel pretty. Any confidence issues which you are carrying around, which we've discussed, that's got to do a whole lot to silence a lot of those worries. It was slightly, well, no, let's not soft pedal it. It was pretty slim pickings today in terms of stories and really great quality matches and tussles. I think the Ferro Thiege match was definitely the standout. We kind of kicked off the day with not necessarily a rip-roaring match, but an interesting result with Daniel Altmaier beating Matteo Berrettini in three straight sets. Who could have predicted that?
Yeah, talking about 50 points. That's what Catherine ended up with for getting that right, which, I mean, she didn't even know who he was last night. Now she's picking him to beat Berrettini and nailing it, which is...
Was that a Berrettini-based prediction, Catherine? It was
a Berrettini-based conviction. I really like Matteo Berrettini. Seems like a nice bloke. I remember watching him play against Gaël Monfils in the quarterfinals of the US Open last year, and it was a sensational match. He really won me over, and it was an electric atmosphere, and he rose to that occasion. It was great to see. But I am not convinced that he's a serial Grand Slam semi-finalist. I find myself slightly underwhelmed by him when I watch him. I feel like it's a slightly out of date style of play. The huge forehand, I feel like he's quite barrel chested, isn't he? And I know there are quite a lot of successful barrel-chested tennis players, but I'm not sure. I don't know. He just doesn't fit the mold for me. I think he'll have a good career, and I think he'll reach Grand Slam quarterfinals. I'm just not wholly convinced. He's sort of on my, if you want some points, potentially ripe for an upset list. And I pulled the trigger on him today. He had some very strong quotes after the match today. He said, "Did he say he was embarrassed?"
Well, he said that on the court.
He put in.
He said that in Italian. It was translated, and then his press conference was quite short. But I counted that he used the word "bad" to describe his own performance 5 times in a very, very short press conference. He was really shocked and disappointed, I think, with how he played, and that game did get exposed. I mean, he's got a very weak backhand considering his top 10 ranking position, and it can get exploited. And Daniel Altmaier was someone I'd never seen play before. I tracked that he'd beaten Struff in straight sets in the previous round, which was an impressive result. But he, on kind of contrary to Berrettini, has power off both wings, and he can really attack with his backhand. His idol is Stan Wawrinka, and he was actually in the crowd when Stan Wawrinka won the French Open in 2015. He got a ticket last minute and managed to watch that match, and he really looks up to Stan Wawrinka. He does that thing where he points to his head like Stan Wawrinka does, and he says "Allez" on the court because he thinks "Allez Dan" sounds a bit like "Allez Stan." And, you know, he's a bit Wawrinka obsessed.
Well, it's a bit intense.
Yeah, well, intense is the word to describe him on court as well. He's very intense and uptight.
Hang on, he says Allez because he's thought through he thinks that sounds right, okay.
Yeah, because he's Daniel.
I mean, that is getting a lit. That's into slightly creepy territory. Yeah. Okay, yep, good luck to him, yep.
I didn't see any of that, but I would say that if you were trying to protect a weak wing, you know, that this is not the tournament in which to do it. I mean, I think there have been a lot of very one-sided matches because you can't really get around a basic imbalance in ground stroke power. So, you know, normally if you're losing, you can gamble. You can try and get a few flashy winners. You can try and change the momentum of a match. But when people get behind on this surface, they absolutely have nowhere to go. And if people find a weakness, you know, as Berrettini backhand, they can just bang away at it because he can't protect himself by hitting power forehands. You know, it's best of 5 this women's tournament. It's on the heaviest clay ever. So it's just completely, it's almost like you could stack up people's power ratios and accuracy, and they're just going to churn out the results almost like a mathematical formula because there's very little space for kind of breaking the mold.
It's a tournament that's violating Carrillo's first law or second law, one of the 3 laws, which is that you've got to be able to protect your weakness. Is that right? Yeah, that's really interesting.
That adds into what you were saying about it potentially being kind of out of date, because if you think back years and years ago, certainly when I was first started watching tennis, there weren't many complete players around. People had a weapon, but they were protecting a weakness, a lot of them. I think it is a lot more difficult to do that these days. You look at players like Jack Sock, who's got that incredible forehand, but I mean, whereas a Kyle Edmund has built on his backhand and made it solid, Sock just hasn't been able to do that. And Berrettini may fall into that category in the long run if he can't sort that out. Just on the subject of Altmaier, I mean, I only saw a few games of the match. I saw enough to get excited about his style of play, but then started to read up on his backstory and found it absolutely fascinating, because when you see somebody this good who's only 22 years of age and is ranked, you know, 180 odd in the world, you just can't work out, well, why is that? And he had horrible injury problems. He had a serious abdominal and shoulder injury that kept him out for the best part of a year. And he was unranked at the start of 2019. So it was a long road back for him to get back to where he is now. And actually, one of the interesting things is he had some sort of scholarship deal with Sky Sports, I think the German branch of, and with crossover to the British branch of the channel as well, because they were doing all sorts of feature pieces on him a couple of years ago when he was up and coming. And he was saying in his press conference today that he was asked about whether he'd had any sort of sports psychology help to help him get over his injuries. And he said not specifically that sort of thing, but he'd had kind of business guidance from people that he'd met along the way, like boxers such as Anthony Joshua and David Haye, and he'd spent a lot of time with them because of his link up with Sky Sports. And so he said, it's just sort of taught me about the mentality of a sporting champion, and I've really grabbed onto what they were telling me. And I kind of take it into all of these matches where I'm playing a bigger name player, a more illustrious player. And the whole Stan Wawrinka thing, it is just a great comparison. And the way he was pointing at his head when he won the match, and the way he sort of just, it's like Sebastian Korda with Nadal, isn't it? It's great to see this generation of players coming through who are playing their idols. We were talking about it a bit yesterday, but you know, they're chuffed to bits to be doing it, and who knows whether they can actually carry it off. But he's a great story.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The real start to the day was probably the British doubles players, wasn't it?
Tell us all about it, Simon.
Well, first it was Jamie Murray and Neil Skupski, who went through in three quite tight sets against second seeds, Granollers and Zibaios. And then Joe Salisbury also won with Rajiv Ram. They won quite easily against Fabrice Martin and Jeremy Shardy. So you're going to get 1,000 words on Louis Caillé in the Sunday Telegraph.
How much space can you get for a doubles-specific piece?
That's a good chunk. I mean, yeah. we buried the singles players last week, so we've got to praise the doubles players today. Well, they're both in those teams, all those three British players are in the quarterfinals of the Slam, and you know, they all owe a debt to Louis Caillé, but obviously I'm talking from a very Brit-centric perspective here for our international audience.
What can you tell us about your piece and about Louis Caillé generally? Because, I mean, he is regarded as a guru, isn't he, within British doubles.
Yeah, so I got a good quote I thought of Luke Bambridge, who told me that Louis is like a cheat code in a computer game because he just allows you to completely shortcut the system. He says, just by using Louis' system, you basically go to about 60 in the world. And he says, well, Louis would probably say about 40 in the world. But whatever that is, I mean, there are seven British players in the top 60 now, all of whom play the same system. And as Bambridge put it, you know, it's about the percentages. So you make the other team beat you by making a lot of first serves, making as many returns into court. And he said, in some ways, maybe it's so prescriptive that it could almost take the magic out of it. But when you're making semis and finals, you don't mind.
At how low a level would that prescription work, Simon? I'm asking for a friend.
No, Louis started, he told me a story which you're going to like, Catherine. He said that it all began, he was 15, he was unloading trucks. Bear in mind, he's 67 now. Unloading trucks to pay for his college tuition. And he was eating his sandwich in the park in Montreal, I think. And there was a pretty 17-year-old coaching tennis. So he said, as his opening line, he said, what do I have to do to work with you? And she said, you have to do the coaching course in September. And then he did the coaching.
And then he married her. Okay. It cut out just before the punchline of the story, Simon. Did he marry her? That's the
no. He got signed to a different park, and then he went from park to club to region to national to international. It took him a long time.
Right. So we've got how many teams still in the? It's all men's doubles, isn't it? And obviously there isn't a mixed. How many teams or how much representation to the Brits do the Brits still have?
So Ram and Salisbury are into the quarterfinals now because they beat Shardy and Martin. We don't know who Salisbury's opponent is yet. And Kravets and Mies, who are the champions, defending champions, are going to be playing Murray and Skupski. But Murray and Skupski beat second seeds in the previous round. So
two teams with British representation remaining in the men's doubles at the quarterfinal stage. That's not bad.
I watched Mo and Herbert win today. They were out on court 14, which seemed to have the best order of play today, and they beat Vasek Pospisil and Jack Sock from match point down. Herbert serving a second serve ace on match point down, and there was quite a nice crowd on that court as well. It was a very tough early round draw, that one, because Sock and Pospisil weren't seeded, but a very good performance from Herbert and Mahou. And Herbert, there was a funny moment at the end of the match, well, kind of funny, but kind of also slightly concerning. He accidentally sort of and intuitively hit the ball into the crowd, which he obviously isn't supposed to be doing at the moment, and sort of immediately, as soon as he'd done it, realised the error of his ways and went out of his way to apologise profusely. And I think the crowd sort of stepped back from the ball, and it was quite an amusing moment, tried not to touch it.
I saw Muguruza throw her towel to somebody the other day who'd asked for it, and it just clearly didn't occur to her that she's not supposed to be doing that.
Oh, God. Other results that we've had today, Khachanov defeated Christian Garin in four sets. I've been very confused by Karen Khachanov over the past couple of years. I don't really know what to expect from him or what he is as a tennis player, but I'd say that's a really, really good win for him. He plays Djokovic now, who just looks in such supreme form. I mean, he barely lost games today. There was an interruption midway through the second set. I think it was a point at which Djokovic hadn't actually dropped a game. I think it might have been at 6-love, 2-love, when there was an interruption to close the roof. And he was just having a laugh and a joke with the groundsman that was sorting out the court because it had been rained on quite heavily and they were having to put a new layer of clay on and they were sweeping and everything. And he just looked like he was playing in the park with his kids, not in the middle of a Grand Slam third round match. I mean, he just looks so in control of his tennis. It's pretty scary stuff for anyone standing in his way of the final, I would say.
I wonder whether Khachanov can be the man who gives him a little bit of a test, you know? Because, I mean, he's in such a tame half of the draw, we thought at the start of the event. But Khachanov is one of those players that promises so much and he looks the part and we keep expecting him to do more than he does. And he's shown signs of it. I wonder whether he can step up. I mean, I tend to think he doesn't really believe enough and he just sort of, he should be more than he is.
Hedging your bets there with Khachanov or Khachanov. Is he not in the Berrettini camp? Like massive forehand, bit one-dimensional?
Possibly. I don't think his weakness is as much of a weakness. I do question...
But he still doesn't have much sophistication. I mean, I know Dan Evans quite likes playing Rublev and Khachanov because when he starts mucking about and slowing the pace and keeping the ball low, they don't really like it much.
I do question the fangs of Khachanov, perhaps.
He's been really consistent at the French Open. It's been his best slam. He's got to round four or better every time he's been there. I hadn't quite appreciated that consistencies he's had there. But when I've been watching Khachanov this tournament, I've been thinking about how he could kind of take that next step and also thinking that Magnus Norman is available as a coach now that Stan Wawrinka has stopped working with him. And I was just trying to think of the player that fits the mould of Stan Wawrinka and Robin Söderling, who have been Magnus Norman's last two people that he's worked with. And he's taken them from someone who's got a big game, but kind of not making the most of it, which is kind of what I would say would be the similarity between Söderling and Wawrinka. Someone, you know, those were players who used to do quite well at slams, and he took them, in Söderling's case, to the final of slams, and in Wawrinka's case, to winning slams. And I don't know, I just wonder whether a guy like Karen Khachanov could be a good pupil for a coach like Magnus Norman.
I like it. He's tried a couple of things, hasn't he? I remember he tried a very brief sort of trial arrangement with Nikolai Davidenko, which, I mean, besides being Russian, I can't imagine what on earth those two would have in common tennis-wise.
Have thought Zverev and Ferrer was going to be a match that worked.
True.
And they seem, so far, signs are fairly positive. Well, pretty positive, aren't they? He reached a Grand Slam final and he seems to be improving. Simon, who's looked the best to you of the three big men?
Yeah, I think Djokovic has probably been the cleanest, hasn't he? I mean, he did look a bit tetchy towards the very end of that match. He just wanted to get it finished and Galan was hanging around and making himself a nuisance. But yeah, I'd say Djokovic is the cleanest and Halep on the women's side. So that's two, you know, top seeds to maybe suggest for what I believe is a tournament, like I say, where the law of averages is going to out in every match and you might have upsets in terms of people that you don't realise how good they are or how well they're going to play on the surface, but you're not going to get people who are going to play well and lose. They're just going to roll over their opponents because they can't be ambushed in the way that you might on a faster surface.
Do you see anybody in Djokovic's half of the draw that could stand in the way of him reaching the finals? So that's all the players that have played and won today. Tsitsipas, he was good today, although Bednay was injured. He plays Dimitrov next. Rublev plays Fucsovics, so you're probably looking at Rublev, Tsitsipas, Khachanov. Can anyone prevent Djokovic from reaching the final?
I don't think so. I mean, Rublev maybe could be a tricky player because he's going to have time to set up those really speedy... I mean, he's got the highest racket head speed on the tour, probably. So he could be somebody who's going to hit lumps through you. But I would have thought that Djokovic has been practicing that drop shot so much and Rublev wouldn't enjoy that. It would catch him out positionally and bring him up and he's not comfortable coming forward. So maybe the only person who could maybe deal with the drop shot is Tsitsipas and he won't be steady enough probably on the backhand-to-backhand rally. So... Really,
he is drop shotting so much, isn't he, Djokovic? I always think that he internally wants to drop shot a lot more than he does. He's always kind of holding himself back. But this tournament, he's just unleashing his inner drop shot dragon.
Well, he massively overindulged in it when he was a teenager. Quite like Andy Murray, he loved hitting it, and he was really good at it. I used to think he was actually better at the drop shot than Murray. But then he got to a point where he was using it because some other aspects of his game weren't working. And he kind of just put it back in the bag for years. I don't really remember seeing him play it for many of his dominant years in 2011 and the years that followed. But he used to play as a backboard primarily, who had some fangs as well. But now I feel like he uses it as his A, creative side, and B, I always think back to that match he played against Zverev when Zverev was looking like a big Djokovic, and my feeling was, crikey, I wonder whether Zverev may just take over Djokovic's mantle because of his ability from the back and the serve. And Djokovic played him the next time he played him. He just kept on floating these short balls to him and bringing him in and making him really uncomfortable. And it showed a completely different side to Djokovic, and that may have been just a tactical switch. But you're right. Now he just uses it as this destructive finisher in rallies. And I mean, I think he's been hitting double figures drop shot winners in every match so far.
And I think it's particularly effective on clay. I think there's sometimes a narrative around clay that it's just kind of baseline tennis back and forth. But I always think back to what Mary Carillo says, and she calls it tennis's classroom, a clay court. And it's the surface which I think actually rewards variety the most in a way. And I remember when Federer won the French Open in 2009, he specifically developed a drop shot that year, a forehand drop shot, which he'd never really had before. And I think he used it because he thought it would help him get Nadal off the baseline a little bit. Turns out he didn't have to play Nadal, and it actually was the perfect weapon to beat Robin Söderling as well, to get him moving and off the baseline. So I definitely think it's both an ingrained part of Djokovic's game, as you said, dating back from when he burst through on the tour, but also a specific tool for him at the French Open currently.
In terms of players in the bottom half of the draw that could prevent Fiona Ferro from reaching the final.
That's not happening.
Other than Sofia Kenin, who she plays next, Yelena Ostapenko has ruined the best, quirkiest record in tennis, and she's lost in the third round. So she's not going to win the French Open, and that's a shame for people on Twitter everywhere.
We can't have nice things in 2020, and that is yet another thing that has been ruined.
Yes, thank you, Paola Badosa, for ruining that. I think Ostapenko was pretty ropey today. I think it was one of those days when it was whatever the opposite of a purple patch is.
Error strewn, the whole performance. Yeah. I mean, I'm part of that was because of her opponent as well. But really, when Ostapenko's on, often doesn't matter who she's playing because she can just hit winner after winner. And she was just nowhere near today.
Ons Jabeur beat Aryna Sabalenka. Matt, I know you watched some of this and said you found watching Sabalenka quite stressful and weren't particularly enjoying the experience. I was out at a dog groomer's at the time, and I was just watching via live scoring, and I said, "Oh, Jabeur Sabalenka looks good. Are you watching, Matt?" And he said, "Yes, but I'm finding it quite stressful."
I love how my tone came across on WhatsApp. I mean, I love a kind of chaotic match, and this one was. I mean, I think Ons Jabeur served for the first set 6-5, 40 love. Sabalenka broke back. Sabalenka had a massive lead in the first set tiebreak, and Ons Jabeur won the set. It was very entertaining and dramatic from that point of view, but Sabalenka is completely all or nothing. And as a viewer, I just find that frustrating. There's no pattern to what she's doing out on the court, and she's too erratic. And I think she's been seeded now in about 2 years worth of slams to get to the fourth round, and she hasn't managed that once. And she's not had, I would say, a lot of bad losses at slams. She's lost to good opponents. Ons Jabeur is a player on the rise. But she's not really had any good wins. And I think that's kind of the breakthrough she needs. And with her big game, that is what she would expect. But she hasn't figured out a way to manage it into a kind of winning formula. And I just got a bit frustrated by it.
She, Jabeur, now plays, and I just double-checked on the score before I said that. I was going to casually say she now plays most likely Garbiñe Muguruza. But she, in her match with Danielle Collins that started on Suzanne Longlen, was suspended because of rain at about 6:30 p.m. local time, 6 p.m. And actually after the conclusion of the Djokovic match, was moved onto Chatrier under the roof. And that is not going well for Muguruza. She's just lost the first set to Danielle Collins, 7-5. So imagine a Jabeur Collins fourth round it would be. Mm. And the other fourth rounds from that section of the draw, you've got Siegmund against Paula Badosa, Fiona Ferro against Sofia Kenin, and Kvitova against Zhang Shuai. I mean, I think that's what you'd call an open section of the draw, an open half of the draw. Crikey.
Taylor Fernandez is pretty good today against Kvitova, wasn't she?
Yes, I believe I didn't watch that much, but I watched a bit of her in Lexington, Kentucky. She won at least one match there, and that was the first time I sort of watched her game solidly, and I was very impressed. She's this tiny little thing. she looks like a sort of junior gymnast or something, but she's got a heck of a game.
I saw some of it, actually, and my daughter walked in while I was watching it, and Fernandez was 5-1 up in the first set at the time. And my daughter came up and said, "Oh, who are you watching?" You know, my daughter's 10. And I said, "Well, Petra Kvitova, who was a Wimbledon champion, and this is Leila Fernandez." And she saw her and she goes, "Oh, she's so sweet." And I said, "Yeah, she is, isn't she?" And I was thinking, but she's playing... Seriously, she's got fangs. She's another one with attitude, and she's bringing it. But she then lost. I don't quite know what happened, because the next time I turned on about half an hour later, she'd lost six games in a row, and Kvitova had got the first set on the board.
Yeah, she is quietly confident, Fernandez. She was asked in her press conference the other day whether she expected to break through to the top 100 in her first year on the tour. She just peaked at 98 a couple of weeks ago, and she said, "Yes, I absolutely did expect that." And it was an interesting match between two lefties, and I don't know whether Simon, as I feel like you have reasonably strong technical knowledge of the game, and I feel like watching Fernandez, she holds the racket in a slightly different place. Her hand is slightly up the grip. You can see a lot of the bottom of the grip when she's playing. And I've been trying to put my finger on why it seems a bit different when she's playing. And I was watching her today, and I think that is the reason. And I'm not sure quite what the advantage of doing that is, but it's definitely noticeable. And she kind of makes up for the fact that she is so tiny by trying to take the ball early and hit it quite flat off both wings. And certainly through the first portion of that match, she wasn't getting hit off the court by Petra Kvitova. But I do wonder whether Kvitova's greater weight of shot eventually just told in that match.
I can tell you, Matt, I watched her play in Lexington alongside Greg Rozetsky, and that was something, the grip, the hand placement on the grip was something he was remarking on a lot, and he didn't understand it at all. He thought it was definitely to her detriment that she was playing that way. So
she's shortening the racket, is she? I mean, I had it on in the background, but I've got to say I had my... Head in Louis Caillé for that phase of the day.
It's the imagery you provide, Simon. That's why we get you on.
I can't say that I was watching that closely, but I mean, if she's shortening the racket, then that probably isn't orthodoxy recommended. I mean, most players tend to use longer rackets if they can. There's a lot of extra long-handled rackets out there for obviously greater leverage and head speed when you swing. So. It'd be quite unusual.
Tomorrow's order of play, I think, matchups-wise, I mean, obviously, if you're a big Djokovic fan or a big Fiona Ferro fan, you'll happily watch them, you know, cruise to victory all day long. But I think in terms of matches that neutrals can get their teeth into, tomorrow's order of play is definitely more appealing than today's. It starts with Halep and Świątek, and then Rafael Nadal superfan Sebastian Korda against Rafael Nadal next. Then Alina Svitolina and Caroline Garcia, and then it's Hugo Gaston against Dominic Thiem. That's the Châtrier schedule. And then Long Len is Trevisan and Kiki Bertens, and then Zverev against Jannik Sinner. I'm very interested in that one. And Lorenzo Sonego against Diego Schwartzman. And then some Herbert Mayu action to round off the day, just to make me cry. Yeah, it's Zverev, Sinner, and but I think both those women's matches on Châtrier are really tasty tomorrow. I'm very interested in how Świątek fares against Halep, because it seems a bit of an impossible task getting a set off Halep this tournament. But I don't know. I really, really believe in Świątek. She's got such a quiet, cool confidence about her. And she's really interesting, I think.
Absolutely, yes. I think it's probably a little bit too early for her to be able to beat Halep, as you said, playing in this kind of form. But I think she's going to be able to perform a lot better than she did last year when she lost in 46 minutes to Halep. And I think she will express herself a lot better on the court. And there'll be some excellent rallies in that one.
Reverse of the Anisimova scenario, where she did well against Halep last year and terribly this year. I got that one badly wrong, because after about one game, I was predicting that it was going to be a ripper, and then it really wasn't.
Yes, I saw your tweet. Get to your TVs now.
Yeah, I mean, she ripped some forehand winners. She had five break points in the opening Halep game, and then after Halep held, she just started missing all those shots that had been screaming into the corners. So that was my prediction for the day. I'll be keeping a close eye on Alina Svitolina, because, you know, in this kind of jingoistic bubble that I live in, we'll be adopting her as the only person with a British coach. And formerly having lived in Fulham before she got with Gail Monfils.
Bubbles are all the rage, Simon. It's the place to be. Of the kind of... the significant men in that bottom half of the draw, basically, out. If we get that Nadal team semi final, which everybody is predicting, on the basis of what you've seen so far, how would you see that going?
I think Rafa's been smoother, hasn't he? I've still enjoyed watching team. I still think that if I could play like anyone, I want to play like Dominic Thiem.
Is there a Louis Kaya cheat code for playing like Dominic Thiem?
Well, you've got to be like phenomenally athletic and powerful and fast. I mean, he kind of is a right-handed Rafa Nadal, as close as you get, although, you know, obviously the Rafa forehand is something that no one else has ever played and probably never will. But in terms of the energy levels and the hustle and the speed and the depth and the way they hang back, so it should be a ripper. Obviously, Rafa's beaten him in two finals here, so you've got to go with Rafa on that one. But and team is going to have some lingering weariness, you've got to think, from New York. So pretty clear who's the favourite, but I still love watching team whatever he's doing.
Well, you've jinxed that match by saying it's going to be a ripper.
Jim Courier today was saying that he suspects there is some lingering fatigue there. He's just, I think we were talking about how team wasn't quite right early on in that match against Rude, and that was perhaps a telltale sign to that. And he kind of hit his way through it. He hung in long enough until he started feeling good. You're not going to get away with that against Nadal. You'll be two sets down. And once Nadal gets into that frame of mind, I think he just won't let him up for air. But I still think that now that Wawrinka isn't in the way, that team may be able to roll into that match. I mean, I know Schwartzman is a possible opponent, isn't he, I think, in the quarterfinals. And Schwartzman's so energetic and so dynamic himself, he may cause him trouble. But it does feel like, you know, when we were in Australia a couple of years ago and we were building up to that Nadal-Djokovic final, we couldn't possibly imagine it not being a belter, and it ended up being a dud because Djokovic was just way too good for him. I'm scared of that scenario because it doesn't seem like that can happen, and yet, of course, it could. So fingers crossed, because on paper, the number of matchups still to come in the men's draw, it may not be as many interesting names in total, but it's just the actual dynamics of the matchups are fantastic.
You enjoying covering it, Simon? You enjoying this French Open?
Well, being in quarantine isn't much fun, I've got to say. Particularly during Storm Alex, which is obviously given everything a kind of twilight feel. So, you know, it's not one that I'd be looking to relive. It's got a certain bizarre quality, and, you know, as reporters, anything that's kind of weirdly different is obviously kind of gives you some material to work with. But it does feel like sort of a bubble, a balloon, let's say, with the air taken out of it, which is also sort of true of almost the conditions. They feel like being on a gymnastics track which has no springs, and just everything's kind of the bounce and the kind of life has been drained out of that court by the weather and the rain.
In a word.
Lovely. Simon, it's great to have your view from having been on the ground in Roland Garros. I'm sorry you're now in quarantine. Such are the times we live in. Yeah, that, I mean, you could be a Tory MP with that kind of bookcase in the background of your Zoom.
Well, life goals, Catherine.
you need some removed and positioned with the front cover outwards. You need the most cerebral ones with the front cover positioned outwards, like it's a Waterstones. Simon has just removed Cézanne and his art just casually from his bookcase.
Simon, you need to have your own book on, you know, yes, as the one that we can see. That's something, yeah, that, like, they all do, isn't it?
Like John Legend with his Grammys casually in the background. There, yeah, it is, Simon.
What's it called again?
Stiff upper lips.
Stiff
and
upper
baggy
lips.
Green caps.
Oh, that's a cricket book, right?
Still available on Amazon.
Right then, always a treat. No post-coital cigarettes today, but yeah, we'll save those for normal slams. Yeah, always a treat, Simon. Thank you. Go back to quarantining and just, yeah, sitting in
my moody manner.
Sitting in your moody manner. Yeah, those were the words I was looking for. David, Matt, thank you. Let's enjoy not being in Paris. And thank you to Cam, a lovely, lovely mascot. If you haven't seen Cam's second video, highly recommend it. The link is in yesterday's show notes.
And today's.
And we'll put them in today's as well, and in the newsletter as well. And Matt's stats, the bar has always been high. I mean, he set the bar. But I think this fortnight, Matt's stats have been better than ever. That some of them are worthy of the top of head blown off emoji, which I try not to overuse.
Matt, just regale to us that one you got about Medvedev and how many slams he would need to win in order to reach the number of Federer wins.
Oh yes, this came about because Wawrinka won his 150th match at a slam, which I always think a stat like that, you need some context to kind of understand what, like, just how good that is. And I think he's the 12th player maybe in the Open era to have won 150 matches at slams. And Federer leads that list with 362 wins, I think. And again, some context for that is that Daniil Medvedev has 25 slam match wins at the moment, meaning that if he won the next 45 slams in a row, he still wouldn't have as many match wins as Roger Federer has at Grand Slams.
That is ridiculous. That really would be the metronomic winning of titles, wouldn't it?
So sign up for the newsletter. That's the sort of stuff you get.
Well worth it, folks. We'll see you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.